Good morning, I'm Tom Garfield. We'll be getting into the seven laws of teaching, just to make sure you're in the right place, the right time. I have to tell you that in Logos' history, the seven laws have taken a rather large, prominent place, but we didn't have the real McCoy right from the start, which was rather a shock to find out. What we started with was the original, that we thought, book by Gregory. But he wrote it in 1884. In 1917, it was purged, essentially, expunged of all biblical references by a group of people in the, I believe it was Princeton, but don't hold me to that. And when we got it in the early 80s, we used it quite a bit and found it very, very delightful and helpful. But just a few years back, we were at a conference like this, and a young man came up and presented to us a photocopy of the original and said this was something he had found. And we looked at it and were just shocked, pleasantly pleased, to discover all the biblical and Christian references that were included in it. So now you can get the original version, the unabridged version, from our table and from other places. But you'll be delighted to discover that it has all sorts of references to the way our Lord taught, for instance. And that is exactly where Gregory got much of his authority for putting together these seven laws, identifying these seven laws. Now, I also need to say this. Teachers all over the world are going to be teaching well, not because they know the seven laws, but because they're doing them. And that's the difference. They don't need to know the secret formula to be able to do the good job that they're doing. And so what Gregory has done is distilled good teaching into seven laws that can be identified, so you might as well know what you're going to be doing, and identify them for us so that we can follow them very clearly and repeat them year after year after year. Unless you are consciously taught and held to account for this, you will default to the way you were taught. You will teach the way your teachers taught you. You can't help it. You're imprinted. Okay, much the same way that as you've grown up and as you've had kids, you are teaching and training your children the way your parents taught you. In fact, that could drive you nuts sometimes. I sound like my mother. Okay, well, that should be a good thing. Okay, but it happens both consciously, you want to do certain things the way they did, and unconsciously, and sometimes that's a sad thing because you're doing things the way they did and you didn't want to. You're imprinted. We're human beings. We imitate. That's what we do when we're little. And that's what happens to teachers. They will teach the way they were taught unless they're taught otherwise to turn it around. Okay? That can be a problem. Just as Mr. Whitling just a little moment ago said, that unless you consciously do something different, you're going to repeat the same mistakes. Okay? Children imitate. We will copy. All right, that's how we're built. Okay, so you can just chew on that. And like I said, it's helpful to know what's happening to you sometimes. All right, okay, well, let's just jump into the laws because we have a bit to cover here. The laws themselves, the way he has them broken down, that they're two personal laws, that is between the directly affecting the teacher and the student, two mental ones, affecting the language and the lesson, dealing with the language and the lesson. Three functional laws or processes for the teacher, for the student, and then for the act of finishing, okay, wrapping things up. Okay? Well, now you get to start filling in things, okay? This is very exciting. The law of the teacher, and these are going to be so profound. If you're not familiar with them, you'll just gasp. You don't have to, but if it comes out, it's okay. A teacher must be one who knows the lesson or truth to be taught. Yes. Teacher must be one who knows the lesson or truth to be taught. That's pretty much the first law. Golly. I studied art a long time. I was going to be an art teacher. And I still remember the first time I saw a Mondrian painting. If you're not familiar with him, don't feel bad. You don't need to be familiar with him. He's the guy that does this graphic thing. It looks like different squares, and they're very dark black. Well, of course, they're dark if they're black. Lines. I love stating the obvious. With white, red, and yellow squares in them very frequently. Okay, little different sizes. If you owned one of those babies, you could retire. Okay? And you look at that and go, I could have done that. I could have done that. Well, the thing is, he did it first. In the world of art, that's the real telling point. Who did it first? It's really not whether there's any quality to it in modern art. Okay? It's who did it first, and if they got a name for it, and especially if you're dead, that helps. So how obvious is it that a teacher must know the truth to be taught? That seems so obvious. Well, guess what? The rest of them are going to almost seem that obvious. They really will. So this is really not that hard. It really isn't that hard to understand. To apply it is a whole other thing. How difficult are the Ten Commandments to understand? There's nothing, you don't have to know Greek, you don't have to know Hebrew. It's right there. Don't murder, you know. How hard is that? Well, okay. So, let's get a little more under the surface. How deep has this teacher studied? These are some questions we ask ourselves with this law. Is this teacher reliant on the text? Well, if you're a first-year teacher, you might live and die by the text. Can you teach Latin? Well, I can probably learn. I did Pig Latin when I was in elementary school. Okay. A first-year teacher is hanging on to every lifeline they can get, and a text is not a bad thing. Okay. So knowing is going to be a little bit more than just reading for the next day, okay, or even for the next week, and trying to stay one step ahead of the kids. It's a little bit more than that. And it's going to take time. Are you an excited student yourself to learn? After years of teaching even, passion for learning on your own. That's part of knowing. How much is there to know about this subject? Oh, not much. Yeah, right. In the world God made, and people do this, you could get a PhD or several of them examining one leaf of one tree for the rest of your life. Correct? I don't know anything about science, so don't push me on that one. But I am very much a Theodore Roosevelt aficionado. Okay? I haven't begun to understand him, and I believe I've read a fair bit about him. And he's a man. He was a limited, finite creature while he was here on Earth for 60 years. I've read a lot about him, and there's a lot more I want to know. So how much do you know before you really know? So the teacher must know. Okay? That should be overwhelming as you start to really think about it. Here's a sample rule or application. Better to know a little well than a lot poorly. The whole jack of all trades type of idea. Better to know a little well than a lot poorly. So, what do? Well, certainly you have a text, but you draw from a variety of sources. A good teacher draws from a variety of sources. Not just the text that you were given or texts that you were given, but you search out more because you're an excited learner yourself. You're honest with the kids on your knowledge. It's okay to say, I don't know. I'll find out. That's all right to do. If you try to fake it, you might be able to pull it off with first graders for a day or two. Probably not. There's just something about that communication when there's... Even first graders can pick up on when there's a shutdown of knowledge and the teacher kind of blanks for a second. It's sort of like a power failure. And what was that? And they see it in your eyes, that look of fear, you know, and humiliation that a first grader asks you something you don't know. Then, you know, you could try the old college thing of, that's outside the scope of this course. Don't do it. A sample violation. By the way, Gregory has this in his book. He has the laws, and then he has some sample rules, and then he has some sample violations in each section. So that's where I'm getting some of these. So these are just a drawing from a few. A sample violation, simply repeating what you've been taught without private personal study. Simply repeating what you've been taught without private personal study. In other words, how do you know it? Or are you just taking it on faith that somebody else told you? And that somebody else could be the text. Now, again, the caveat being, if you're a first-year teacher, you just might have to do that. It's okay. But do not settle for that. Don't ever settle for that. Don't ever settle for just going by hearsay or the text says. Okay? If you're subbing for a class, that's, yeah, okay, fine. I've done that tons of times. Student says, I can't find this. You can come over and, well, I've never seen this in my life before, and it's in the middle of the page. Read the thing. Okay? That's all right in a subbing situation. It's not adequate for teaching. So that's a sample violation. Also, not reviewing familiar material beforehand. This would be more for the veteran teacher. I've done this course so many times, I could do it in my sleep. Okay? Bad idea. Plus, it diminishes your enthusiasm, I believe. If you practice that idea of, I can cruise. Well, what happens when you put on cruise control? The temptation is to fall asleep. Don't do that with your teaching. Okay, need to keep moving. The law of the learner. We could say student. The law of the learner. A learner or student is one who attends with interest to the lesson. Okay, we're still not dealing with heavy, profound philosophical issues yet. So the student is paying attention. Attending with interest. Well, again, as always with these things, you'll find there's a little bit more to it. If they're not attending, they won't learn. If they're not interested, they won't retain, and they certainly won't love. And I dare say probably many of our school's mission statements or goals says something about the love of learning or teaching the kids to love learning. You must be interested with a contagious enthusiasm, and it really doesn't matter what your personality type is, by the way. It really doesn't. If you are enthusiastic, it will be contagious and it will be obvious. If you are not, it is also equally obvious. Okay? Dispassionate discourse sounds and is as fascinating as cold oatmeal. Quote me on that. You want them to love what you love. I mean, my goodness sakes, what are you doing teaching if you don't love them and love what you're teaching? So let that come through. But just like every other kind of love that's worth having, it takes discipline. It takes work. It's an act of the will. It is not an act of the emotions. That takes work, just like marriage. Love and marriage takes work and discipline. And, of course, it has its benefits on the emotional side, too. But if you're waiting to feel like you want to teach, you're going to be waiting a while. That will not be all you need to attain and retain their interest, though. That enthusiasm. Require it from them and encourage it. Gregory has three levels of interest. This is where he sounds like he's getting a little bit into psychobabble, but he's not. It really does make sense. He's observed students. He's observed people. And he's come up with three levels of interest. Active, passive, and secondary passive. Active, passive, and secondary passive. Active interest is if I threw a live boa constrictor into the crowd. I dare say I'd have your interest. Actively. Okay? That would do it. And you can do that with the kids. You know, when I was in the College of Education, they had all sorts of things related to your lesson plans, and there was kind of this, I think they called it the set. Yeah, I don't know if they call it that anymore. Anyway, it was 100 years ago. But you know, this idea of, you know, you're setting them. Well, there's nothing wrong with that. You're throwing out some interesting propositions, or you're doing something to spark their interest at the very outset of the lesson. Good. That's good. That's getting their interest. But Gregory maintains, and I think you understand this too, you can't sustain that. Much as you might try to be a Sesame Street type of approach, you can't sustain it all the time. Bye. You know. You don't try it. It's not good. It's bad. Okay? So active interest, it's good to elicit, but don't expect to sustain it. Passive interest, it could be a good thing, but he's saying that's what people settle into you know, when they're being polite, but that's real, that's only a real step away. He doesn't say this, I do, but that's only a step away from the glaze. Okay? Okay? Eyes are open, lights are on, nobody's home. Okay? That happens. So what you want to go for is what he calls, and he coins this term, secondary passive. That is where you're comfortably, the student is, in a sense, comfortably attending with interest, which is what I hope you're doing right now. Okay? That it's, you're not active where your adrenaline is going, but you're not so passive that you're pretty much ready to go to sleep. Okay? Or that the words are just humming by you. But secondary passive, that you're attending with interest, it's not difficult, the students are ready to take in what you've got. Okay, that's what you want to aim for. Okay, a sample rule for this attention is go for secondary passive, of course. Be aware of what sparks their interest. Okay, I've watched this, I like to watch people too. I've watched this with sermons in various places where I've sat under a different pastor. I've been under Mr. Wilson for more than 30 years. And I've seen this happen too, but there's something that happens when somebody starts telling a story. Have you ever noticed that? So the speaker will be talking about these really cold, abstract thoughts. And then he says, well, the other day when I was mowing my lawn, everybody just, it's like, you know, they wake up a little bit. I've seen that happen in the classroom, too. People like stories. People like real-life stories. I wish I could share more with you, but we don't have time. I have to go through this abstract stuff a little bit. But you have time with your kids. So where you can bring in, and I'm talking about K through 12, where you can bring in stories, not necessarily about your own, but where you bring in stories, they're going to pay that much more attention. They're going to follow it better. We're designed that way. We're hardwired that way to like stories. So that's another sample rule. Okay? A sample violation, starting or continuing work without the complete attention of the students, teaching or teaching when there's no interest left. I mean, it's as pointless to try to teach when you don't have their attention as it is to say, all right, you know, the bell rings. Have you seen this? The bell rings for the end of class, and the teacher says, okay, just a couple more points here. Yeah. You've got the 10% who always get A's who will stay there and actually still be attentive. They'll be following the second law. And everybody else is already checked out. They may physically be there, but they're folding up their books. They're, you know, they're on their way out the door. Okay, that is so silly, and yet lots of teachers do it. Well, it's the same effect as even if the bell doesn't ring, if the students are gone and the teacher doesn't know it. They've checked out. They are so passive as to be hardly awake in any form. Okay, the pulse might register. But the teacher just keeps on going. You see this a lot in colleges. It's really pathetic. Okay? So don't do that. Or, worse yet, that assuming the children will hang on every word or action. I am so fascinating. Or this topic is so fascinating. How could they not be interested in calculus? Yeah. Sorry. I'm sure it can be interesting. Okay? What is it going to take to do this particular rule? Well, it's going to take knowing their frames, knowing the students' frames. If you're teaching third grade, know what third graders are like, as opposed to fourth graders or second graders. How do they function? Again, as a first-year teacher, that's going to take a lot of study on your part. But understand their frames. A shift of attention, a change of pace. All right, let's all stand up and sing this now. You don't do that just because variety is the spice of life. You do it because it's good for teaching, and it keeps their attention. Okay, need to keep moving. The law of the language. The language used as a medium, could also use the word vehicle there, but let's say medium, between teacher and learner must be common to both. The language used as a medium between teacher and learner must be common to both. Now, we're not saying that, you know, you've got a class of French kids and you're speaking Swahili. It's not that obvious. Okay? You always have to spell these things out. How do the students understand and use the words that you're using, or you think they're understanding? If you're as old as I am, you might remember a guy named Art Linkletter. Oh, you're not as old as I am. You are? Okay. Well, good. I'm glad you know Art Linkletter, even if you're not as old as I am. He was a good man. But he had this program, Kids Say the Darndest Things. What were many of them? They were mistakes, weren't they? They were errors, and they were so darn cute. The way they said something, they thought, this is the standard phrase, oh, say, can you see, or whatever, and they come up with something totally bizarre that relates more to their understanding. And it's cute. Well, of course it's cute. And there's nothing wrong with cute in that context. But it is a mistake. It's an error. And if you're in a classroom situation, you don't want that error to continue. It's going to affect their future learning. So you need to correct it. Well, what are we getting at here? Is that the very, very frequent misuse of language between the teacher and the student, and the teacher goes on as though we all are literally on the same page. Okay? That's a mistake. That is not checking the language. That's not making sure that there is a common understanding of what this term is. So again, what is that going to require? It's going to require that you know where those trip points are. You know when you're introducing new terminology. Okay? And it's not as simple as just a new vocabulary list. It could be the vocabulary you are using to introduce the new vocabulary list. And they're trying to figure out what the heck you said, and you're on to point number three. You see? So there has to be something done about that. I have to tell you this because it's so great. This happens at all levels, not just first and second grade. This happens up through high school. My favorite class is the one I teach each spring, which is Modern U.S. History. I teach it to sophomores, so they're pretty sharp kids, okay? Or at least they think they are. Sophomores, wise fools, right? That's what that means. Anyway, on the final test I gave to a students a year ago or so, I had them do, I had a museum of artifacts that I had shown them over the course of the semester, and they were supposed to pick out 8 artifacts and tell me not just what they were, but what they meant, okay, in the course of history. What does this mean? All right. This one young lady had picked out a car. I had several cars. I loved collecting model cars, and she had picked out a car to describe as what it meant to the boomers. It was a station wagon, okay? And hopefully you can run that out, and I won't take the time right now. But what that all meant in terms of symbolizing the boomer generation of the 50s. Well, she went on and on how they needed this car for more space for all the new kids and for mom to take dad to the station, which is where you get the name, etc. She made one little error. One little error. And maybe it's because I had more than one car out there. She identified it as a Volkswagen instead of a station wagon. But she used all the right phrasing so that they would have more room, lots of space for the kids in this Volkswagen. I had a lot of fun with that, and I still have a lot of fun with that. And I tell her that I tell hundreds of people this. I didn't totally flunk her on that, but I had a lot of fun with it. But that was one little mistake, one little clarification, misuse of the language. Volkswagen, station wagon, what's the diff? Okay? Well, so what do we want to do? Since language is the vehicle of understanding, we need to check it. A sample rule then to get them to answer as fully as possible. Answer as fully as possible. It should be pretty rare that you get a yes or a no or a one or three as an answer. Make them say more. Verbal and written as much as possible. I understand. Please understand. I understand that having the kids write a lot is a real pain because guess what? You get to grade it. But it is one of the best ways to show what they know. And I'm talking more, of course, by the older kids here. But the younger ones, too. It is so good when I go in and watch a third grade teacher and she says, gives a math problem. Usually there's some kind of object related to it. And so instead of just three what? There would be 3 apples left. Okay, that's probably not third grade. Okay? Make them answer completely. That's how you know they know. A sample violation. Okay? Attention and compliance. This is kind of back to that. Don't always mean understanding. In other words, just having them answer these little monosyllabic ways does not necessarily mean they understand. If you don't check, you don't know. Okay? Have to move on. The law of the lesson. The law of the lesson. You know your stuff. The kids are paying attention. You know you're speaking their language. The lesson to be mastered must be explicable in terms of the truth already known to the learner. Another way of putting it, the unknown must be explained by means of the known. I'll run that through one more time. The lesson to be mastered must be explicable in terms of truth already known to the learner. In other words, the unknown must be explained by means of the known. Frankly, in most of the problems with a student's understanding, this is the most common. The teacher didn't plan the instruction, in other words, to link to something that had already gone before that was well grasped. Okay? Think of our Lord again. Of course, this is the best way, place to look. He has these massive heavenly truths, spiritual truths, and he's trying to bring them to the understanding of essentially peasants back in Jerusalem. So what does he use? Does he talk in large, abstract, philosophical terms? No. He talks about seeds, and he talks about sheep, and he talks about gates and doors and lambs, buildings, food. Things they already understood, you see? He derives from that and then says, the kingdom of heaven is like this, something you're already familiar with. He didn't do that just because it was poetical, which I guess it is. He did it because it worked. They understood seeds and sheep. Well, what do your kids understand? Okay, use their experience, their benefit, to their benefit. What have they been through? If you've studied them and you remember your own childhood, you'll probably have a pretty good idea. But that's just the broad sense. Getting it down to brass tacks, if you want to continue the lesson that you started yesterday and you want to do something new today, link it to what you did yesterday. That seems so obvious, and it happens so rarely. Just plunge right in and, okay, we're on a new thing now. Okay? So what's a sample rule? Well, communicate the grammar, and of course, hopefully you know what I mean by that, not just English grammar, the details. Communicate the grammar of the new material in planned steps. Move from the known to the unknown after finding out what they know. A sample violation is no attempt at integrating or assessing previous knowledge. There's no prioritization. You're not doing this, okay? As a first-year teacher, again, this is easy to do. You want to dump. You've got so many miles to go before you sleep, and you want to get there. And it's real simple, you think, to just plan each day, bam, 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 bam. And by Friday, I'll be here. Well, you might be, but where are the kids? They're back on Wednesday, you know. Okay? Yeah, it's a little frustrating sometimes to have to slow down, back up, go over something again. But that's you're teaching. You're not running a course in that sense. You're teaching. You need to bring them with you. To go back over it is not a pain. Paul said that too. To repeat the same things is not a pain. Because I want you to understand it. And so you go back, did we grasp this? And sometimes that does, yes, mean reteaching. Okay? All right. Let's do a quick review. Teacher needs to what? Know the stuff. Okay? Students need to be doing what? Paying attention. All right. The language must be what? Common. Very good. And the lesson needs to be built on? Previous knowledge. Very good. We can see, you can rephrase it and it still means the same thing. All right. The law of the teaching process. What? We haven't even started teaching yet. No. So what is teaching? Teaching is arousing, good word, teaching is arousing and using the pupil's mind to grasp the desired thought or to master the desired art. Teaching is arousing and using the pupil's mind to grasp the desired thought or to master the desired art. Twisbat. Familiar with that? Twisbat. T-S-W-B-A-T. The student will be able to. Isn't that fun? See, when you get into... Teachers want to be so much like professionals. We want to have our own vocabulary just like doctors and lawyers do. So that we can confuse people. And so when we... Anyway. I'm not saying you're not professionals. Don't take that as an insult. But we are in the art of communicating thought. And so hiding behind strange little acronyms and things is not really the best idea. Let doctors and lawyers and car mechanics do that. Twisbat. The student will be able to. That, at least when I was going through college, was everything. That was what you introduced. That was part of your lesson plan. By the time you're done with your lesson, the student will be able to X. All right? Well, that sounds good. I mean, you do want the students to be able to do things after you've taught them or think things. But teaching is not the student's work. Learning is the student's work. Teaching is your job. Okay, so what is teaching? Well, it's what we just said. It's arousing and using the pupil's mind. So you need to know how to do that. Okay, the work and the instruction of learning lies greatly, surprise, surprise, with you, the teacher. Not that the student will be able to. Yes, that's hopefully a byproduct, because that indicates they've learned something. But the work is up to you. So the teacher is responsible for planning ways to engage the minds of the pupils. It's very, very much of what we are especially into in classical instruction. Learning to learn. Remember, that's at the very end of Sayers' article. The point of education is learning how to learn. It's not so much the stuff. A sample rule, excite and direct the self-activities of the pupil. Generally tell him nothing he can learn himself. Okay? Now, let me touch that again. Excite and direct the self-activities of the pupil. Generally, tell him nothing he can learn himself. In other words, have you planned so well that the students have to work? I just got done saying it's your work. Yes, it's your work. You're planning to make sure that they work. Or are you the source of entertainment? Only they probably wouldn't pay for it. It's not their idea of entertainment. But if that's how you view yourself, that I've got to do this three-ring circus to keep their attention. I heard that part about attention, so I'm going to do this all this stuff to keep their attention. No. Your work largely is to make them work. You see that? They work. That's what we mean by self-activities, that they work. Gregory goes into a good discourse on what do you learn best, something that somebody just told you or something that you discovered? Right, something you discovered, seemingly discovered. The wonder of education. A good teacher makes it seem like the students have discovered this themselves. Did you ever think about this? And that can be done, not at just the wonder years. Sadly, we call them that when they're little. Okay, and that is a wonderful time. But the wonder of education can continue and should through high school. They shouldn't burn out. That's just something I get really upset about. They shouldn't get tired of school in the interest sense. Of course, they're physically going to get tired at times. That's good. That means they've been working. And yeah, they want a break. You want a break. But the idea of continually discovering new things is your work. A sample violation, by not planning for their work, you deny them the love of learning. If they don't get to do something, you're doing it all. And yeah, even if you love it, which I hope you do, you're denying them the opportunity to learn to love it. Let them work. Okay. And just remember, you're not as fascinating as you might think you are. Let the material that you're trying to introduce them to, or the person that you're introducing them to. TR is far more fascinating than I am, and I like to have the kids be introduced to him. And so my job is to introduce him to them as though he is still alive. The law of the learning process. Learning is thinking into one's own understanding a new idea or skill. A new idea or truth, or working into habit a new art or skill. Let me do that again. Learning is thinking into one's own understanding a new idea or truth, or working into habit a new art or skill. Okay, so obviously this is the flip side of teaching. You've planned for them to work. This is their work. And what is their work? Thinking into their own thoughts. It's got a process. God gives us food to process. We don't just add it to our bodies, although sometimes it seems like that. Just kind of pad with food. Okay? No, we take it in and our body consumes it. It breaks it down and digests it, and it goes into all sorts of little places and makes us stronger and healthier. Well, that's what's supposed to be happening with the information, the material that you are feeding them. They need to digest it. And that's what that's getting at. This is the flip side of our work. Pretty much, in other words, if it's not digested, it's just lost. All right? Here too, though, you have a lot of work to do. You have a lot of role to play. Particularly, I'd say, at the rhetoric level, but we'll leave that for just a few moments. A sample rule: keep in mind the level of the students, and why should be a frequent question asked of them. Why? Now, this is probably more at the dialectic level. But still, you could do it at the younger grades. Why? We've talked about this. Now, why is that true? Why did he do that? Why did this happen? Okay? A sample violation? Haste. Or just too much to do in the day or the year. And it makes thought, application, digestion virtually impossible. You know what I'm talking about. You've been given a lot to do over the course of a year. Well, it still takes time to make sure that they have time to process this. Okay? Just remember how long it took you to get it. Whatever it is. Okay? So haste, in other words, trying to rush, or just not allowing enough time, is a violation of this law. The law of review and application. This one's pretty straight up. The test and proof of teaching done, the finishing and fastening, I like that word, fastening process, must be a reviewing, rethinking, re-knowing, one more, reproducing and applying of the material that has been taught, the knowledge and ideals and arts that have been communicated. We have a saying at Logos that comes around at every quarter's end, review, review, review. Sort of like the real estate thing, location, location, location. Okay, you're trying to emphasize something there, I guess. Okay, review really matters. It's not just a nice period to put at the end of the sentence. It really matters. John Saxon made gazillion dollars off of this rule. If you're familiar with Saxon math and now other materials, really that's all he did. He didn't come up with a new math system. Math has been around for a long, long time, all those laws. What Saxon did was he incorporated in his books review. Stop and review. Stop and review. And son of a gun, he made a gazillion dollars off of that. I think Gregory should have gotten some of that. Well, too late. But that's really what it is. Stop and review. It cements what's supposed to be there. So a good sample rule would be seek out ways to apply prior and important knowledge, not just a test. In other words, yes, of course, testing is reviewing, but there should be reviewing in addition to the test, and reviewing in a way that emphasizes what you want them to understand as the priorities there. If everything's important, nothing's important. You guys know that. So what the review does is it draws out and says, now look at this. We took this all apart. Now we put it back together, and here, this is what it means. And of course, you help them to articulate that, so you're not just telling them again. It's reproducing. Okay? A sample violation is not doing it. That could probably be true of all these, but a sample violation is not doing it, not reviewing, not taking the time, because it does take time. You have to allow time for review. The opposite of that, of course, is a summary at the beginning of the, or at the end, but also doing it at the beginning of the lesson. Or waiting till the semester's end, and that's the only time you review. No. An excellent way is to stop at very frequent points and say, what have we learned so far? What have we learned so far? That can be a test. That can be a verbal kind of questioning. It could be a variety of things, and it should be. I handed out, or I didn't hand out, but a number of you handed out, and I'd be happy to reproduce these. I like little things that help you, mnemonic devices that help you. This kicker, K-I-C-K-E-R-R, one letter for each law. If you'd like a copy of that and you didn't get one, I'll tell you what, I will leave this at the registration desk. How about that, so you don't have to come and try to catch me. I will leave this at the registration desk. And if you'd like to pick up a copy, they'll have them available, all right, for the ACCS thing. Well, the seven laws dovetail wonderfully with classical education. How do they do that? Well, it's a consistent philosophy of education. In other words, it applies to just about everybody everywhere. Okay? This works, and it works almost universally. Gregory offers us another view of time when teaching, like a lot of philosophically based endeavors, was absolutist in its approach. Okay, we believe education can be measured. We believe teaching can be measured. They both work. Classical education works because it cuts with the grain of the way children are. The seven laws works because it's really the way people learn, the way people can teach and teach successfully. It's a systematic approach, but it's not just dull and dry. It works. It also is like classical education in that it takes into account the characteristics of the students. You see? He refers to that in here, taking into account the characteristics of the students. These seven laws can be applied and will look a little differently, of course, from first grade to 10th grade. And he allows for that, if you want to put it that way. Hopefully, as you noted, as you will note when you read this, he talks about the frame of the students and how this is going to look like this with third graders, or this is going to take more time with eighth graders. Okay? But he allows for that. The integration and sequencing of the material, classical education, of course, emphasizes that. I hope you understand that. Same thing with Gregory, the integration of material. These laws encourage a natural integration. You don't just, I'm going to only work on this law this week. Now, you might need to when you're first learning them, but ultimately, as you can see, they certainly interrelate. They interrelate. So there's a lot of integration, which is a reflection of course, the universe. Okay. Teachers need a fixed beacon for determining their bearings. You need to know that you're doing a good job. So to reemphasize what I tried to point out at the beginning, you can know that you're doing a good job. You can compare yourself with these kinds of laws, these particular laws, and say, am I doing them? Read through the violations. If you've been teaching for more than a year, they'll hit home, I guarantee you. Oh, my word, I did that too. Okay? Just for what it's worth, I like to tell new teachers that pretty much you're going to hit your stride by about the third year. The first year, you're going to make a lot of mistakes. Second year, you're going to spend time fixing those mistakes, making new ones. And the third, you're going to kind of feel like you're finally getting it. So don't be discouraged. Like I said, this book is available. Hope you enjoy it. God bless you.